everybody. Welcome to another episode of Mango Talks TV. I'm Chris Lee. We're back. My co-host Spencer. Spencer, how are you?
Excited to be back, man. It feels like it has been years.
It has been 2.5 weeks, but I do appreciate that you miss me so much that it did, you know, the days feel like months, the months feel like years. That's how much you miss me, Spencer.
100% true, and not what I was talking about.
I'll tell you, the last two or three episodes that we were doing of our last podcast when we were doing Severance, my voice was just gone. It was just shot. And it was gone for like 2 months. I'm just barely getting it back. You can hear it's not perfect yet, but it's like, it's definitely stronger than it was before. So I appreciate all the people who follow show to show for hanging in there with me in the last few weeks of Severance. I was really struggling. I think it'll be a little bit better today. Spencer, we are covering season 2 of Last of Us. Episode 1 of season 2 has premiered. I don't think we have any housekeeping really to get to. We're going to cover this season like we do all seasons of television here on Mangum Talks TV now. Going forward, is we'll have the short form episodes. That's what you're getting today. It won't be that long. We'll do a casual review of the episode. And then we're going to work two long form episodes into this season review coverage. So somewhere in the midpoint, episode 3 or 4, we'll do a long form episode. And then on the finale, we'll do a long form episode. Long form episodes where we go line by line through the script. It usually takes about 2.5-3 hours. We really dive in to what's going on in the show. Short form episodes like we have today, that's where we kind of kick around the episode. We talk about it, laugh and joke. It's usually a tight hour and we get out. So that's the format, Spencer. We're reviewing Last of Us Season 2. We watched episode 1. What did you think?
I liked it. I mean, I thought it was very much intended to be kind of arranging the pieces on the board of what are beginning to the movers and shakers of this season, and reminding us also where the characters are and also what has happened to them over the course of the 5-year gap that we had between the end of last season and the start of this one. But I thought it was good. I thought it was well filmed. I thought it was well acted. Wasn't necessarily enthralled by it, but I thought it was good television, and I'm kind of... It gives me the various playing cards I'm going to be using when it comes to the deck of this season.
I had a little bit of a difficult time getting back into it. It just took me a little while to get my feet under me about the season and get really invested in what was going on. It was slow. I mean, I think they wanted it to feel like you're in the world. This show has never been paced at a breakneck pace, right? Season one was not a breakneck pace. But it did take me a little bit of time to really get into it. It wasn't until the therapist scene.
Highlight of the episode.
Where I really kind of locked back in, because then we got a lot of Joel and his weirdness with Ellie, but also the sweetness that's there with Ellie. And that whole scene I'm really enjoying. Now, I will say that the first 2 minutes slapped when Abby... This is the girl named Abby?
This is Abby, yes. Abby and Gabe.
Abby was ready to kill a motherfucker, and I was down. I was like, I like this Abby. I think she's going places. And then we cut away from her. We didn't get her again until the end of the episode. So I liked the first 2 minutes, then there was a lull, and I got kind of back into it. I suspect that this is more of a function of the fact that I've not played the video games, and it took almost 2 years to get this season of television out. I think that's it. That's what I'm dealing with right now.
Yeah, I'm in a kind of interesting camp of where I played the first game, but I've never owned a PlayStation, so I've only played some of the second game. Now, being a gamer who has existed over the last 10 years, I have been spoiled with some of the plot points that I know happened in the game, and I'm kind of anticipating here on the television show, but I don't know really how we're going to get from A to B to C, because I've never actually played it live. So... unlike the first season, I'm only a little bit more knowledgeable than you are, and even what knowledge I have could be misleading. So it's going to be kind of curious for both of us where this season goes.
Yeah, so we got new characters. We got a whole crop of new people around Abby, played by Caitlin Dever.
Who appear to be basically the survivors, the Firefly survivors of Joel's rampage from the end of season one.
That's right. So... you know, the lesson is there, right? Your past will catch up with you. You can't run away from it, right? Like, he clearly thought or hoped that he could do this thing and lie to Ellie and leave it behind. And it doesn't seem like he's going to be able to do that because there's survivors and they're chasing him. Now, at least Abby it seems to be chasing him because for like a vengeance because of what he did. Mm-hmm. But I imagine there's an element of they need, still need to get Ellie, right? Because she does have this ability to.
Yeah, I was curious your thoughts on that. I was curious your thoughts on that. What we saw, I read the tea leaves in this is that the people that survived, or at least this cluster of them, they don't seem like any of them were high ranking in the Firefly organization, to the point that some of them even like doubt that Ellie exists or doubt that she could exist as an immune person. What knowledge they had seems like it was just passed down the grapevine, rumors and innuendo, not something that they were intimately familiar with or were part of the planning of. So the main vibe I got from them is that Abby wants to go kill people, and these guys are her friends and have her back. It seems like she's kind of the driving force, whereas the rest of them are like, there's this group in Washington we could go to. It's like, nope, we gotta kill them, we gotta kill them, we gotta kill them. It's like, okay, you're a bud, we'll support you in this murder quest. Revenge quest, more right. accurately.
Yeah, I mean, Abby clearly is on a revenge murder quest. Murder revenge quest, as we'll call it here on Mangum Talks TV.
Understood.
But I think I would be surprised if it doesn't morph into, well, we can still get Ellie, we can still connect her. Like that.
She could be there.
I feel like, I know storytelling, you know, and I think that that's, you need to revive that through the remaining Fireflies in some way. If they don't have that express purpose now, maybe they run into other Fireflies, you know, they're because that plot of her being immune and them trying to use that to, you know, save people by developing, you know, some sort of medicine or something for this disease, that has to continue to run through. Otherwise, it becomes so fucking bleak, I'm not sure what I'm watching.
I mean, it's interesting, too, because it is something they definitely wanted to remind us about several times in this episode. They really wanted to hammer back into us that, oh, yeah, remember? She's immune. This girl, the one that just got bitten again on screen, immune. Don't forget. So you may be right. The fact that she is immune may be an integral plot point again this season. And I'm with you. It kind of would be weird if they just kind of left that as just individual background rather than something that is of potentially world-changing importance. Though, they could be just building off the fact that, no, Joel just utterly closed that door, and that's a sin of his that we need to just resonate in the world.
But then what are we doing? What is the show? If the show is not, there's some way to fight this thing, then what are we watching?
We are seeing civilization rebuild. I mean, how did you feel about getting to see how Jackson, Wyoming has progressed over the course of the last 5 years? It seems like it's actually kind of a bustling town, as it were.
I suppose. I mean, but it just seems small and somewhat futile if they're not able to deal with the fact that all the rest of the fucking world is infected with this thing. So, you know, maybe you could be in a situation where these individual settlements could lock it down and they could go 2, 3, 4 generations and then all of the
infected spore people die out
and then they repopulate. I mean, but like, my God, what are we watching at that point? Like I got to jump 80 years, you know,
we've jumped.
I think you got to, I could be wrong, but knowing what I know about storytelling, I think you got to keep some thread of Ellie's immune. Her connection with the Fireflies can, you know, create, you know, some hope here through a connection to some medical someone somewhere that maybe Joe won't kill this time.
Well, to build off that point, you in particular were very critical of Joel from a moral standpoint, or at least from a broader, like, John Stuart Mill utilitarian standpoint, that he picked his own individual wants over the greater benefit of greater potential benefit to mankind. Are you then leaning somewhat in favor of our Fireflies as protagonists for this season?
Absolutely. Abby needs to get this revenge. I know that I realize that we follow Joel, and it seems that all of America now loves Pedro Pascal. Like it's like he's like the big thing, right? This is probably news to you. Oh, I forgot who I was talking to. Spencer.
Who is this strange man you're talking about?
Pedro Pascal, the same guy from Mandalorian. He has caught fire in the world, in pop culture. Like he's like on the top, on the cover of like a Variety magazine. He's on the cover of like Rolling Stone. He's, you know, big celebrity and like, he's now vaulted into serious category, like an A celebrity. Like he's up there with like, name him, like Kevin Hart, The Rock, et cetera. Like he's that big now. And I recognize that we love him and we want to keep him on the show. But this thing that Joel did last season is absolutely unforgivable. It was wrong. And here's how you know it's wrong.
Tell.
Two plus two equals four. Hmm. It's wrong because he tells no one what he did.
And he's hiding it from
everybody. He feels guilty about it. He almost breaks down in tears in front of a drunk Catherine O'Hara this episode about it. And, you know, he won't tell Ellie what he did. He lied to Ellie about it. So he clearly knows that what he did was wrong because it's wrong on a bunch of different levels. Not to rehash last season, but I think it's important to set the groundwork for how I feel about the plot as they've laid it out in this episode. I think he was wrong because the idea that you can help humanity move past this thing that has basically wiped out the planet. It's been the apocalypse. 90-something% of people are dead from it. And you have the opportunity to help clear that out, give people some immunity, and give humanity a chance. You have to take it. And beyond that, Ellie's wish was to do it. She wanted to do it. You have to honor that wish. Like, that's it. She gets to do that. So all of it's fucked.
When it comes to Joel's guilt, though, here's an important caveat to say there. He clearly seems
Dog barking in the background?
That is a different dog barking in the background, not my dog. My dog is asleep post-surgery right here on the ground here in front of me.
That's why I brought it up, because you told me before we started that your dog had surgery today, so I was going to ask if he's all right.
Little Hazel's doing okay. She got neutered, and she's doing fine with it, though thoroughly pissed off at me about putting her through it.
Shout out, Hazel.
When it comes to Pedro Pascal, though, who I am familiar with, I got to see him voice a DreamWorks Fox not that long ago in The Wild Robot with Catherine O'Hara playing an opossum. So, you know, I know things in popular culture. When it comes, though, to his guilt, here's a question. He clearly seems like he feels guilty. He clearly seems like he's struggling with it. Why? We can ponder that. But do you think he would do differently now, 5 years later, than he did back then?
No, I don't. I don't think he would do anything differently because of how you can see it in the monologue. You can watch it. He feels guilty. I think he feels guilty about the line.
Shuts down.
I think he feels guilty about the line. I think he feels guilty about holding it in and not telling the people of Jackson what he'd done. But I don't think he feels guilty about the act itself because he gets steely-eyed and he says, I protected her. And he still seems to think that that was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a guy who has not learned his lesson. And I think that's a problem. And then over here, you know, maybe same room but different corner, you've got the problem of he's wildly overbearing to a headstrong Ellie who
he's all of 19 and acting like it,
and also is not his daughter. Like, she really isn't, dude. Like, you don't need to flare up and like threaten to punch people in the face when they call that out. She isn't your daughter, and it's important for you to acknowledge that and talk about that because it's important to her. It's something known to her. And she'll continue. She thinks she mulls on that all the time. So he's got a lot of fucking issues. I'm glad he's seeing a therapist. Can we talk about the therapist for a moment?
Therapist scene was my favorite of the episode, as said. I thought it was very well handled. Catherine O'Hara is great in everything I've seen her in, and she knocks it out of the park when it comes to this role. And Pedro Pascal, you mock me for not knowing his acting roles, but the man can act. The scene of watching him process through trying to answer her question, answer it, and then shut down when it comes to continuing further with the discussion was brilliantly done. Wonderful facial acting going into that. So easily my favorite scene of the episode, watching her talk through, reveal, as a good therapist does, reveal something about themselves, engage on that basis, and it seemed like it cut through a lot of Joel's stony exterior, but only for so long before he caulked that hole back up.
So let me be clear. I was not saying that you didn't know Pedro Pascal's acting. I was saying that you were probably unaware that he has become such a cultural phenomenon.
A darling.
That he's caught fire. That he's a high Hollywood darling right now. We of course know his acting through The Mandalorian, which he covered on Magnum Talk Star Wars
and Game of Thrones and like 35 other things. He's in everything nowadays, it seems.
We've covered a lot of Pedro Pascal, and the fact that he bothered to show up for work in this one is really great, and he didn't just like send it a voice recording on his phone. I really appreciate that. Thank you, Pedro, for actually showing up in person. No, he's fantastic. And you know, when you hear him talk, when you hear Pedro Pascal like give an interview and people talk about him, he's this like oddly emotive guy. Like if you ask him like a basic question on the red carpet, like what was it like working with, you know, actor X, he might start crying at like a memory of a dinner that they had that was like really important to him. And that's probably miserable to live like. Like, he probably feels a lot, and that's probably like not an easy way to exist, but it probably allows him to like drop into someone else and feel those feelings really authentically, you know, in a really like really efficient way. So he probably is able to do that at a clip a lot better than a lot of other actors because he has this like reptilian sort of emotive sense about him. I thought the therapist scene was the highlight of the episode. It's the highlight of what they're setting up this season, I think. I mean, because you were right. I agree with everything you said about how she gave a nugget of something about herself and that opened him up. Right. Mm-hmm. But a therapist can't do that on their first session. And they certainly can't, the thing that they share can't be, I want to fucking kill you. You know, you killed my husband. I fucking hate you or whatever, you know, there's serious trust established. And it's clear that there was, because as soon as she dropped it, he didn't get mad, didn't toss the table, he didn't leave. Instead, he took the lesson that she was trying to impart, which was you have to say a hard truth to move past it. And so then he tried to do it, and he got farther than I thought that he would. But the problem and why I think he's not sharing it is because he still thinks he did the right thing.
He refers to himself almost petulantly as, I'm a good guy. Why doesn't she see me as a good guy? And I'm looking at Joe saying, Joe, you're many things, you're many commendable things, but you are not a good guy.
Most people who walk around saying that aren't good guys.
We are all the protagonists of our own story. The fact that he axiomatically refers to himself in that way is even more than he did previously back in like season one. For in season one, he was like, yeah, Greg, doing necessary things. But now, on the other hand, he's saying, yeah, well, she should recognize I'm a good guy. I wonder what degree that is just, you know, a falsehood that he's even recognizes himself as made up, or whether he's actually kind of in some way convinced himself that his actions are fully necessary and justifiable and whatever else. I'm leaning more in favor of that it's a fiction even to him based on his emotional reaction when the therapist is asking him to reveal this painful truth that he's not willing to admit. But more evidence will tell. What did you make of the, it was an interesting nuance where the therapist said, I hate you for this, particularly for how you did it. It's like, I know you had to kill my husband. Clearly he was infected. You had to put him down in some shape or form. But I can't ever forgive you because of how you did it. What do you make out of that? Just normal Joel brutality or something particularly unique? It seems like she was really calling out that particular detail.
So just for the listeners, you probably heard some background noise there as Spencer was talking. That's what that is that when Spencer is so popular as a podcast host that when he starts making a really good point, his neighbors will yell at him sometimes.
But they're contributing like, background.
They're like, go kick ass. Do it. Do it, bro. That's right. You show Lee. I think that, I mean, I get in danger with this. This is a dangerous moment because I feel like the answer is right there for us. It's like we know Joel, right? So he probably just shot him like a dog. He probably just shot him, and not even like a dog. He loves dogs. It's probably like shot him like a fucking, you know, a deer, an infected deer. He shot. He was probably heartless, right in the head, and then just drug him out by his ankles. That's what I envision Joel doing in that situation, and I could see how it would really. Harm the psyche of somebody who knows both Joel and loves the person who is infected.
As a person who seemingly is even called out in this episode is becoming more Joel-y, how do you feel about our girl Ellie over the course of the last 5 years?
I think Ellie is like, other than the brief moment of Abby, Ellie is like the only thing that was really entertaining me this season or this episode. You know, Bella Ramsey seems sort of made for this role. I'm not sure that I like Bella Ramsey a lot, but I'm not sure I would just drop her in anything. Mm-hmm. But this role in particular, she's just, it feels so authentic and natural on the screen. And she's doing such a great job with it. And I find her really riveting and entertaining in a way that it could not be. Like, it could be very easy to find Ellie annoying. Mm-hmm. Because she is an annoying person sort of in the abstract, right? This sort of like hyper aggressive behavior, this, I won't let anybody in, you know, like, no, you don't know me. Like, you know, the violence, constantly unnecessary violence, that could be a really frustrating part of a character to watch. But the way it's portrayed, I find it in a weird way, sort of refreshing, but certainly entertaining.
I find it very real too, because one of the seminal moments that we saw for her is Joel, as she believed. I mean, we ended season one thinking that she thought Joel was full of shit. that she knew Joel did what Joel did, and that his lie just makes it all the worse, right? That's kind of where we both ended up.
Yep.
So someone, in what is unquestionably, from his perspective, a profound act of love, murdered other people for her. And in response to that, she spent the last 5 years becoming hardened so that no one else feels the need to do that for her, and isolate herself so that no one cares enough to do that for her, including, in particular, cutting off the person that did it previously. I find that very believable. I find that very real. I find that tragic that, you know, a person that was joking, playful, creative, very adventurous, wanted to seemingly meet other people while at the same time being a little psychopath, as other people called her out, has now just defaulted more towards psychopath. Now, she has people still in her camp. She has people that still care. We got to meet Dina, who I think we briefly saw in the background at certain times in season one. And she seems really into Ellie and really wants to draw her out of whatever state voluntary monkish murderhood she's chosen to put herself in. But seems like she, even then, she's having to cut through a few layers to get there.
Yeah, Dina, really hope you weren't just drunk. Really hope for your sake you weren't just drunk. I think hopefully you are ready to follow through with this, because I don't think Ellie does well with being spurned. You know, very clear that she was into Dina during that. I didn't. It's a little hard for me to care about, like, you know, mid-teen romance, you know, in the middle of all this going on. But I guess it's a big tent show, something for everybody.
The personal connections are part of what matters, man.
I suppose. I'll tell you what didn't work for me.
What didn't
any
work for
scene, you? Any scene with Tommy and Maria.
What in particular did not work for you about the leadership of our good town in Wyoming?
What are we watching? Like, what is the point of the show? Like, if you want to give me a show that is zombie apocalypse, and now we are rebuilding society, and we're going to learn about the governance structure and what it takes to actually have a settlement in a ruined, you know, ruined world that was industrialized.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to learn about the council decisions, and we're going to learn about the votes and the buildings and the building schedule. I'm fucking all in, dude. I will watch that show. I promise you. I am nothing if not a system bureaucrat head. I will love it.
The process of rebuilding the world. This is what this man is here for.
I'm down, but that's not this show. And so every time they cut to them being like, well, we got to build buildings faster, I'm like, I feel like this is a moment where the rest of the audience and myself to a certain extent are going, okay, can we hurry up and get to the point we care about, which is, you know, how are we going to resolve, you know, Ellie being immune, that plot line, and Abby coming to kill fucking Joel.
It'd be really curious for me to see, because I'm with you. I hope this isn't just a one-off thing, but I'm going the other camp. I hope they develop this more. I hope that this isn't just a doomed hometown, that they suggested in this episode that the roots of the Cordyceps are coming into the town. I'm hoping that it's not just going to be, and the town got infected and everybody dies. I want this to persist. I'm pessimistic on the idea that they're going to find a cure at this point anymore. I'm hopeful more that it's going to be some kind of small town rebuilding kind of thing. So I want towns like this to continue to exist, to continue to be a base, for it to be hard, for them to have to endure, for them to have to overcome. But I hope that isn't just a one-note thing that's going to be written off in two episodes' time of, oh yeah, the Cordyceps got in, now everybody died, yeah, doesn't that suck? Moving on to other things. That would feel like a waste. I'm with you, it doesn't seem like it's going to be front and center, but it's important background for me to make the world sustainable.
There's probably a way to tell the story where the Cordyceps come in and it does kill everybody except for the handful of people you want to continue with the plot. And you could do it in a really stark, like, quick way that would be appropriate and sort of emblematic of the world that you're in. Like, when you're in this post-apocalyptic world, there are going to be, you know, people who die very quickly and suddenly.
Sure.
And you just have to move on. And in part of me feels like it'd be like apropos to do it in like the middle of episode two, just like 25 minutes in, just Jackson's gone and then, okay, we move on. Like, because that's kind of the world you live in. Although that starts to creep into bad storytelling, but it would be appropriate for the environment that you've developed. I find the plot of this show a bit meandering and a little lost. And I just keep coming back to, what are we watching? Like, what is the purpose of this whole thing?
What is the central theme, and what is our ultimate objective?
What do they want the audience to care about? I sometimes have a hard time figuring that out. Is it, Ellie's romantic life? Because they certainly put that front and center in the last 10 minutes of the episode. Is it her relationship with Joel? Because that seems sort of doomed from the start. And I'm not sure anybody watching the show with two open eyes thinks that that's going to like end positively. Is it the rebuilding of society and Jackson? Or is it Ellie and her immunization and the potential ability to link up with the Bioplast, find immunity, save society? It's good to have a couple threads going, right? But when you got four or five main threads and they're all sort of like coexisting, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like it's meandering.
I'd be curious to say, I feel like the show wants to treat things like the cure, like the town, the big things as background to intimate personal character stories, focusing on what you said, Joel and Ellie, Ellie and Dina, Abby in terms of her own personal trauma and reasons for revenge, and our own ethical quandaries when it comes to the people we care about versus the people that are trying to kill them for unjustifiable reasons. I think that's what the show wants to be, and a lot of the other things that you find particularly fascinating, and I find particularly fascinating, are going to be there, but never front and center. At least never again front and center, when it even comes to the cure, though. If the cure is going to be front and center, rather than just merely the fact that she's immune and that the infection is there in that regard, I'm going to expect to see threads early. Because they got to give us some... Like, when it came to the cure and came to the importance of it, they hit that in, like, episode one, episode two, season one. It was the thread to guide us through the season. And then it completely jumped the tracks when Joel murdered everyone that made that possible. For that to become the central plot line again, they have to give us some hint that there are other tracks that a train can go on, which at present... Only suggestion we have is that there are other Fireflies to be found in Washington. Otherwise, we don't have much, other than that the show wants to keep reminding us that Ellie's immune.
Right. And that's... it's well said. I'm not... obviously not against... Like Epic Fantasy. I'm not against shows that have multiple plots going, but typically there's one to two main plots that you can identify as, like, the raison d'etre for the show. Like, this is what the show is.
Mm-hmm.
Wheel of Time right now, we're covering over on a podcast feed as the Wheel of Time turns. There's a lot of things going on in that show. But the primary thread is preparing the dragon to fight the Dark One. That's it. The dragon, Randalthor, dragon. He's a dragon. He's going to fight the Dark One. Like, we got to prepare him for it. And that's the show. And now that's a little easier to explain than something like, maybe Severance, right? Where the main sure. thread's a little harder, but you still know what you're paying attention to. You're paying attention to humanity versus the corporation. Will some sort of ethics, some ethical champion be able to pierce the armor of this all powerful corporation? You know what you're rooting for. You know the good guys, bad guys. Little confused on this show. I think they'll clear it up. I think you're right. I think they'll... I actually got excited when I saw that the Cordyceps was like sneaking into the town, because I was like, okay, that's maybe going to be the thing
mm-hmm.
that we're paying attention to.
One of the other things that we got this episode that was explicitly highlighted as new and unexpected and oh, isn't that interesting, should we believe them, is the idea of a smart infected. The idea of an infected that isn't just going to bum rush you, that isn't just going to be drawn in by noise, but is actually going to, in many ways, stalk you, trick you, lead you into traps. That was something that it seemed like our characters, many of whom are very experienced hunters, had never seen before. Is that a suggestion that there is a broader world out there? Is that a suggestion that the nature of the Cordyceps infection is changing or can evolve, or that there can be unique examples within it? We saw the characters ponder that within this episode, which has to highlight to me that that is going to be a bit of a theme of the season.
It felt to me like that was, we're at the next video game and we got to make the gameplay a little harder. So like, you got to make sure that the
this is the new mini boss we have to confront.
Yeah, the red shirts that you're fighting have to like be slightly different. I didn't know what to make of that other than a point that you made on the first, our coverage of the first season, over and over again, sort of rang in my head, where you kept asking me, when do you think consciousness leaves the infected?
Right. When are they dead?
How long do they have their brain and are they thinking as themselves?
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the sort of underlying question of that, like, is there a certain period or maybe all the way through where they're just a prisoner in an infected body and they're still thinking, they're still their mind? That ran through my mind because it might be some evidence that that that's the case, that, that they're still able to sort of think in that prisoner body.
It sounded like she was sobbing. It sounded like she was in pain. This didn't seem like something that was fully an automaton, something that was just fully being puppeteered. This felt like an individual that was, I don't necessarily know resisting, but aware and not happy with their present condition. Whether that is universal, whether she's representative of an entire different class of infected we've seen, don't know for sure, but it's definitely the vibes I was getting from her.
Who do you think the audience is for this show?
It can't just be the people that played the video game, right?
Can't be.
A standard HBO crowd that's going to watch whatever new HBO show, particularly by Craig Mazin, that comes out, it's got to be at least a share of that.
That's typically 35 to 55, you know, upper middle class, educated, mostly white. That's the HBO crowd.
It's also going to be a crowd that's into zombie things, because there's a definitely established community that is into a zombie post-apocalyptic aspects of that are being brought, that are drawn in, I would say, by this.
So, I feel like that whittles it down slightly, but yeah, I agree. I'm having trouble figuring out who the audience is, because they certainly play to a younger crowd with Ellie's storyline. And putting that so front and center, I was a little confused by that. You could still have that plot line, but that much of the episode to it is makes me question who they're trying to capture in the show.
What did you make of Dina as a character, by the way, given that she seems like she's going to be one of our leads when it comes to this season? She seems like the show wants to say, and I think I felt it a bit too, that she has a charisma that affects people around her. I mean, she seems like she has drawn Joel out of his shell to the point that he actually enjoys her company, which cannot be easy to do. And then everybody else in the community seems like they like her or know her, that she is at least a focal point of the social circles. She is the anti-Ellie in a lot of ways, is what I'm kind of going for.
You know, you do a good job. You know what you're really good at, Spencer? Let me give you a compliment.
Well, please. So rare this is.
You are very good at asking a question while you answer it.
Thank you. I try.
You're like, what do you think of this character? And then you would describe the character perfectly. Like, I don't have a better answer for the character than what you just said. That was exactly the character. I'll tell you this. I wouldn't buy a life insurance policy for her.
A doomed love interest?
Or I wouldn't sell one. I'm not. I don't feel good about her prospects on the show, because in post-apocalyptic literature, the charismatic one who gives everybody hope, that is the bright spot in everybody's lives, usually doesn't do very well. But yeah, I agree with you 100%. That seems to be what they're trying to show you, is that we've got a lot of downers. Got a lot of downers on the show, and she's an upper.
Would it be repetitive, though, to murder her, given that one of the main background points we have for Ellie, pre-Joel Ellie, is that her love interest died in her arms? That she had to kill her love interest in her arms after she got infected? Are they allowed to do that again in a way that would work?
Feels like the fundamental tension of post-apocalyptic literature, right? Is that she would likely just die probably the same way. Like, you know, like, there would be a lot of repetition.
Yeah.
But you... As a storyteller, you try to get away from that. I don't think she'll die the same way, but I do think she'll die.
Actually, here's a thought. One of the things that we saw with Joel was his unwillingness to have that story play out the same way again led him to murder people, led him to kill a whole collection of people, because the same plot line was about to repeat, kind of, and so desperate to avoid having that happen, he abandoned any concept of morality. Arguably, we can debate such. We have debated such. You and I think, leaned in a certain camp, maybe different than some other aspects of the fandom. Could the show then be setting up some aspect of that for Ellie? Of where, here's another love interest, here's another person that's going to bring her out of her shell, here's another person that's going to make her more than just a murder hobo, and then it's going to set up a scenario of where she has to choose between saving her and otherwise sacrificing something else that she cares about. Is that something that they want to set up? They want to give her... Make her understand Joel by making her have to live through Joel's storyline.
I would like that. I hope you're on the writing staff of the show, because that would be an interesting place to go with it, for sure. That'd be a very interesting place to go with it. But I tend to think that what we're going to get this season is a bunch of side stories, because that seems to be how they're telling this story. And the main one that I am going to care about is Abby v. Joel. give me that. I don't know when what episode that's going to be, but it's coming.
It was our first scene and it was our last scene, so I think it's probably going to be front and center.
It's coming, and yeah, I think give me Abby here. I'm rooting for Abby here. I think not only did Joel do something that was unforgivable. Well, nothing really in life is unforgivable. Shout out J.R.R. Tolkien, but it's pretty terrible, and I'm rooting for her to at least help him see that he was wrong in that. And I think probably her anger will make him reassess his position. Possibly. I don't know. Joel's pretty hard headed, but I also think it'd be good for the show to reset it. Right. I don't want season three of, oh man, Joel's being too protective with Ellie. You got to keep it moving from a storyline perspective. And if you kill Joel, that would be a really great way to do that, I think.
Any other points you want to hit when it comes to high points and low points of the episode? Oh, one other thing to note. I enjoyed the, not necessarily hypocrisy, but delightful inconsistency when it came to Ellie and her willingness to talk about or reveal her infection. That she wanted to show off to Tommy that, I don't care, I'm going to shout it to the whole world, who cares, whatever else. But we also got to saw that she seemed like she chemically burned her arm and then tattooed it over. And then in the course of this episode, used a knife to kind of carve a pattern into herself to hide her other bite. So she wants to, put on the surface that, it doesn't matter to her. She's above all those kind of things. Who cares if she knows? While at the same time, in private, she's literally scarring herself to hide this aspect of who she is.
Yeah, and that was the type of, I put inconsistency in quotes, that is consistent for a 19-year-old. Right. That's it, that sort of showmanship until it gets real.
Yeah. It's consistent for the character to be inconsistent in that way.
Yeah, that is what I would expect from a 19. Cue Catherine O'Hara telling us, oh, it's the most important story in the world. It's just a 19-year-old. She was fantastic. And the slow realization of the audience and Joel that she had been drinking since way before and that she was a little loose that day. And then so your lens gets tilted, right? When he looks at the bottle and you start piecing it together, he starts piecing it together. Oh, man, she's fucking loaded. And then she starts saying crazy shit. But then the focus comes right back in when you realize, wait a second, she's doing this for a reason and it's working for Joel. That was a high point. That was really, really good.
And I love, we talked about, inconsistencies and inconsistencies. I love that she wasn't one note. They easily just played that she hates Joel for what he did. And so they're playing off that. They almost could just play it for humor, but she says she hates him. But then she says at the end, now you tell yours and I promise you, I will help you. I will be here for you. And I believed her to the core of my being when she said that. And that is a delightful complexity to a person. I don't know if we're ever going to meet this character again. I hope so. She's interesting.
Oh, yeah.
But in scene, they gave me a rounded character that was well done. Kudos.
She's coming back, and we know it because of the scene at the end at the party.
She's watching at the party.
If that character was meant to be a one, episodic character for this episode, I don't think they show her again on the dance floor. You know what's interesting about that comment? That was really cool that you called that out, where she's like, I will help you, I will get you through it, is I believed her 100% when it came to a barrier to helping him related to her husband's death. I believed that she would work past that to help him. What I was not so sure about is when she found out
what
that
he did.
Prevented the world from having a cure to this thing. I wasn't so sure that she could handle that and keep going. I think that she wasn't quite prepared for just how heavy what he was going to drop on her was.
Potentially killed her husband 4 years later by not inserting any kind of vaccine or preventative into the broader ecosystem.
And millions of people.
Sure.
So, yeah, I think that's enough. We can cut to our segments if you'd like to.
Kind of an opening segment, pun of the episode. Where does Bear BQ rank on your 10-point pun scale? Very scientific 10-point pun scale.
So, I'll tell you what this is. This is when you have a friend and they have a love interest in their life that comes around. And it might be, they might have been with this person for 4 or 5 months or something. They're enough to be comfortable, but they're still new and you're meeting them for the first time. And this person is talking and your buddy is just hemming and hawing, eating it up, stars in their eyes. And you're looking at the partner and you're going, that wasn't that fun. That wasn't
but
that good.
She's
not that interesting. And then you kind of have to fake it. That's kind of what it felt like for me. Not that good, but Ellie chose to think it was good because she's got stars in her eyes. And my affection for Ellie carried the day. So I'm going to say B minus.
A B minus on your 10-point scale. Very impressive.
Yeah, it's pretty strong.
All right, how about quote of the episode? I got a few options if you want me to give you a few.
Yeah, give me some quotes. Let's do it.
One that I just found amusing early, just because this, I like when they remind us that Joel's a contractor. I like that that's his role in the community is primarily to do contracting rather than to be, you know, a murderer for hire, because it's where he started. So when he's being browbeat on the subject of we need to build more buildings, and he's like, that's literally impossible. I love the way he put it up. See, we got this dial called the constructometer, and the more you turn it, the faster we go. It's like, sure, I get you wanting to do this. There is a limit on possibility, and it's not just a contractor talking right now.
I mean, give me the show where he is procurement planning. He is sending people out for rare and precious metals, you know, for reclamation of buildings and coming back and trying to retrofit what they already have. Oh, yeah, this would be great.
One that followed immediately after that was Joel, and her name's Marie, right?
That's right.
Arguing on the subject of letting in more people, of where he points out, we're running out of space to put these people. Yeah, no, well, she says, running out of space to put people. Yeah, I noticed. Maybe your council should stop letting so many in. It's our council. These people are fleeing collapsed settlements. They're fleeing infected. We're supposed to leave them out there? If our light bulb is swamped, yeah, we'd leave them out there. He realizes the harshness of what he says, and he tries to dial it back a little. If I could, I'd let them all in. And I'm working every damn day and night to make more space. You know that. But you got to look out for your own first, or you're no good to anyone. It's a relatively common conversation to have in a post-apocalyptic setting, but it is hitting into both personal themes when it comes to the character of what he prioritizes and what he seemingly over the last 5 years has at least broadened his focus to care enough to want, and I believe him, want to help other people and serve this cause. But he's always still going to be Joel, and he's always going to still assign his people the priority.
One of the best types of arguments, because they're both right, and the devil's in the details. Like, they're both right. You got to let as many people in as you possibly can. But Joel's also right that it can be overrun, so you just got to work it out. See, this is a fledgling bureaucratic masterpiece here. They're almost there. Spencer.
Only they had a different focus. The entire therapist scene, I'm not going to go through all the quote of it, but the entire scene, pretty much from the moment she says, I've done this so long to know when somebody is leaving something out, and you were definitely leaving something out, ending with her and Joel eventually saying, you know, I saved her and walking away. No notes. Wonderfully well executed. Great scene. Well done. Hope we get more of these two characters talking with each other. Wasn't ever expecting Joel to attend therapy, you know. Maybe I'm inspired myself, but glad to actually see it.
I'd like to have a scene with them. Hey, show. I know the showrunner listens.
Yeah, yeah.
When they're having a scene, let's make it the next episode. You could do some quick reshoots. They're having a scene and they're talking, Catherine O'Hara and Pedro Pascal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'd like Catherine O'Hara's character to have a monologue where she goes, so Joel, you think I'm just going to sit here like an airhead and say, and then you know how people will like do like an affected Valley Girl accent
yes.
to drive the point home. And then she can do her Schitt's Creek character. She can build it right in.
I hear you. I get why you want that. I'm going to rate that a 2 out of 10 when it comes to possibility, just on the Spencer index of likelihood and reality.
Yeah. You know, Community had a scene like that where they had the guy who played Omar.
Yeah.
And Michael K. Williams, and he did. He finally like did. He looked at it in the show. He turned. Mm-hmm. He looked. He said, "A man's got to have a code." And I was like, I wanted it to happen so bad, and then when it happened, it felt cheap. So maybe yeah. I don't want it.
They're quoting Lily Tomlin, but it's still a good line. Reality is nothing but a collective hunch. Well said, Lily. Well said.
Well said.
One from near the end, the scene back and forth between Dina and Ellie. Every guy in this room is staring at you right now. Maybe they're staring at you. They're not. Maybe they're jealous of you. No reason to be. I'm not a threat. Oh, Ellie. I think they should be terrified of you. Lee's giving us the thumbs down. He doesn't stand for teen romance. He wants all teens to be unhappy and alone. May that have worked rather well.
I hope they all get together or don't get together. Whatever. But whatever. All of you be in love or don't be in love. Whatever's best for you. But just have a great time. Just leave me out of it. The thing that was the most interesting to me in that was when Ellie, when she said all the boys are looking at you. And then Dina says, they could be looking at you. And she goes,
no,
they're not. But she says it that the way that this is where I feel like it's next level having Bella Ramsey do this. Mm-hmm. Because the way that she says this, it's like, I have a lifetime of knowing that they are not looking at me. And it was almost, there's a sadness to it, but that's also kind of funny because she doesn't like guys anyway, but like just, you know, knows that that type of, you know, affection is not typically, you know, sort of given to her. So that the weight and the delivery of how she did that was the best thing of that scene.
I like that quite a bit. So I'm with you. It didn't come across as angry. It didn't come across as, you know, distraught. It didn't come across as even resigned. It came across as someone who has processed this for years and has come to terms with it.
Experienced. Yeah, she's experienced with it. But yeah, and it didn't seem pain. You're right. It didn't seem pain because there was a smirk. She almost laughed at the concept. Those types of things where we're getting into who the character is. Like the fact that Ellie is queer is more interesting to me than she's in a relationship with this whoever, mm-hmm. because how has she been able to deal with that in this collapsed society? Is there prejudice against that? Is she able to actually have a pool of people to date from? You know, if she misses the mark and hits on a straight girl, is that a problem in this society? Like, I don't know the answers to any of this shit because it's a collapsed society that's rebuilding. All that stuff is interesting to me.
There clearly is some tension. We had a person that referred to them by a certain slur in the course of them dancing together.
Fuck that guy.
Which Joel's, we had Joel come out absolutely nowhere, just off the left side of the screen, and just knock him over.
Yeah, and like proving my middle-aged maleness, right? I'm like cheering for Joel, and then you realize like he shouldn't have done that. Like you're part of the responsibility of you have to a child, or is it any child you're looking after, is the step away period where you start to let them handle things, and you cannot crowd them the rest of their life. Baby bird's got to leave the nest, and he's failing in that right.
Particularly
now.
When again the major point in their past is he murdered people to do what he thought was protecting her. It was protecting her, but he took that decision away from her. He used violence to do what he wanted as part of protecting her. The fact that he's now doing that again, writ small, ain't going to improve the overall tension between the two of them.
Do you think that her reaction, which was harsher than she had wanted, right? You could tell that she, after she did it, she softened and she was like, shit, I wish I hadn't just like snapped at him that way. At least that's the feeling I got from the character. Do you think that the harshness of that reaction, the emotion of the reaction, is charged from Ellie knowing what Joel did? Like she does know?
At least in part, yes. And it was interesting to see the character at the end when she was walking past that porch. It seemed like for a half second she wanted to join him on that porch, but caught herself and walked away.
I mean, that's the thing about, you know, fighting with people that you love, right? Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, even in the middle of the fight, sometimes you miss them. Like you might be fighting with them for like days, and then you're like, oh man, I wish I could talk to, like, Spencer and I, big blowout. We get in all the fights all the time.
Oh yeah.
Let's say Spencer and I get a big fight this week. You know, by Friday, I'm like, man, I wish I knew what Spencer was going to say about this, but oh, we're fighting, but I can't, you know, like, so you can miss somebody that you care about in the middle of a fight. That kind of felt like what it was. She'd had a hard night, and I think she wanted to just relax with him.
So what is your quote of the episode, sir?
Yeah, it's got to be the one that we got where it was like, gosh knows, what was the quote about?
Within the therapist scene?
No, it was, doggone it. I can't believe I'm blanking on this.
Give us a hint.
Say, what was one of the earlier ones you did?
It was the scene between Joel and Marie back and forth when they're talking about, you know, investing resources in the community and about, you know, the constructometer and things along those lines. Or Lily Tomlin's reality is nothing but a collective hunch. Any of those ringing a bell?
It's going to come to me in like 12 seconds. It's bad radio. Let's move on and I'll bring it. I'll come back.
I believe you wanted to offer a bit of a therapy couch with Lee. Did you not?
I did. Therapy time with Lee. So this is what we're going to do. Now, since therapy has taken a front role in this season, I hope it continues. I hope this dynamic here with the therapist and the character of Catherine O'Hara stays. We're going to have a segment where it's therapy time with Lee. So this week, I wanted to say, because I have a podcast and I can.
This is your platform.
I wanted to put it out in the ether for everyone to hear that my dog passed away about 10 days ago. Hmm. And I had my dog for 12 years. And his name was Emerson. And he was an absolutely fantastic being. And, you know, I think that part of the reason that people struggle so much with animal deaths, at least I do, and I suspect other people do, is because there's a sense that no one understands. You know, that's why you get, you go on social media and you see these like really long-winded posts from people, like where they put the picture of their dog and it's like RIP, the dog has died. And then they do like five paragraphs about the dog. Mm-hmm. And it can seem a little self-serving. I get why people do that, because they are thinking this entity has died. This beautiful creature has died and no one knows how great they were. Mm-hmm. Like that's the sadness that I'm experiencing, is that no one knows. I feel like no one knows how great he was, how awesome he was, how much I didn't deserve him, how much the world didn't deserve him. I'm like angry that the world hasn't just stopped, that people haven't just bowed their head every time, or maybe just for the last 10 days. Like that'd probably be appropriate too. If the whole world could have stopped for 10 days, I might be like slightly, I might 20% feel like we've honored him enough. Like that's how it's been difficult for me to comprehend that he's a dog, he's passed, we move on, and everyone's not going to just celebrate him all the time because that's what he deserved. Mm-hmm. So that's been really, really tough for me. But part of the difficulty is realizing that he's not my responsibility anymore. You know, I don't know what, if there's something beyond this life, I don't know if he's going to like go somewhere or there's an afterlife or something, but regardless, he's not my responsibility anymore. You know, I've got to go with my responsibilities. I still have responsibilities. Mm-hmm. This podcast, for instance, I have cats, friends, family, job. So I have to go with my responsibilities. That's not my responsibility anymore. So the extremely loose tie-in, the single bare thread I'm going to do with the episode to pull it all back,
waiting for it,
is that Joel has to realize that Ellie is not his responsibility anymore. He cannot go around treating her like a child. And I think the only way he's going to settle into a sustainable relationship with her is if he lets her live her life in a relatively independent way. He's got to come to terms with the idea everything about our relationship is different. She's grown up. She doesn't want me to take this role on. I have to let her sort of exist. And this idea that you're letting go, not my responsibility anymore. So that's my advice to Joel. And also, because I have a podcast and because I can do it, I've put somewhere in the ether that will go on the internet, that will live on, that I had the world's best dog. His name was Emerson, and I will miss him every day. There you go, Spencer. That's the segment.
And on the subject of Joel, I think you probably bring up a good point when it comes to the things that Joel needs to do in terms of moving on when it comes to either his relationship with Ellie or his past trauma for losing his daughter. And I think we're seeing that he's doing some of those things. He has a relationship with, he has a friendship, it seems, with another person, Dina. He seems like he has a loving relationship when it comes to his nephew. He's dedicating himself to the purpose of serving the community in a way I didn't expect that Joel would be capable of. I think he's actually doing some of the steps necessary to move on from being fixated on Ellie as a replacement daughter, from needing to either control her or protect her or just make her the focus of his life. I think we're getting to see in some ways he is doing necessary steps for going to do that, but he's not able to fully come to terms with that fact yet, that what he is doing is healthy, that what he's doing is the right steps. It hurts, it's hard, but it's an important part of moving on and coping. And I think we're getting to see Joel do that a bit while also go through the necessary mechanics of accepting that that's the case and that's what he's doing.
And I suspect he'll be terrible at it. And I suspect this will be a main point of tension in the episode, that he's not very good at it and that he continues to sort of have these moments where he's too protective and Ellie and him fight over that and et cetera, et cetera. But you're right. That's the place that he's at and that's where he needs to get to. I have remembered the best line of the episode. It's Joel when he says, you have to take care of your own or you're no good to anybody. Yeah. Because I love the applicability of that to the sort of, you know, oxygen mask in the plane metaphor of you got to make sure your house is in order before you go cleaning up the street outside, that sort of thing. There's metaphors everywhere in this, but you get the idea.
And also to speak on your other point, I liked Emerson quite a bit. Emerson was an absolutely wonderful dog. I will miss him. He was an absolute delight every time I got to see him, and it is a shame to no longer have him around.
It doesn't seem, you know, it just doesn't seem like right. And it also at times dealing with that, it just didn't seem like I could go on. Like I'm okay. I don't mean I'm going to do something or whatever, but it just didn't, I couldn't imagine a reality where I was existing without, without my buddy there. Right. Like, and I really, you know, in a way, Spencer, that, it's a beautiful thing because it will give me the opportunity for intense empathy for people going through the same thing. Mm-hmm. I now will understand that sort of like just abject, like it, like it, nothing will ever be the same pain when you lose a pet. And if you don't have a pet and you don't understand it and you're going, man, I wish he'd shut up about his dog. You know, I feel sorry for you because pets are pretty awesome. And, you only hurt so much because you cared so much before. So that's what I got for you this week, Spencer. We are going to get another dog. When we do, I will absolutely update our podcast audience on that. I suspect it'll be 2 or 3 weeks and we'll have another little buddy around because we want to put our energy towards something. By then, we'll probably be right about long episode territory, right about episode 3 or 4, where we're going to do a long form episode. Any concluding thoughts on episode 1? And then real briefly, I want any predictions you have for the rest of the season, but let's do concluding thoughts for episode 1.
I liked the episode fine. I think it was a very intro episode. We've had other episodes of television which didn't necessarily feel like as much of an intro as this felt. So I think it is necessary. I think it is structural. I think how I will look back on it will depend a lot of where the threads that seemingly are being laid out here will go over the course of the season. But on its own feet, I thought it was good. I didn't think it was necessarily great, but the parts that we got were well made. And ultimately interesting. The themes of the show that I pick up are themes that will work for me, and where they will ultimately go, I'm willing to watch how that happens. In terms of predictions,
Let me say what I thought, too.
Please, yeah.
I think, we good with a 6 out of 10? Can we give it a 6 out of 10 as an episode?
You can give it a 6 out of 10. I'll give it a 7 out of 10 there. 6.5.
Yeah. Okay. Spencer has a 6.333.
It's not,
he does not have the same score as me. Just 6. Clock that.
6.182.
6.182 versus a 6. Yeah, it's slightly over average. I agree. I would have said it was maybe average or a tick below without the inclusion of Catherine O'Hara and that dynamic. That's my thought on it. All right, let's get your thoughts on the remainder of season 2.
I think this is going to be a revenge arc. That is what I'm thinking. That is our opening. That is our closing, is focused on Abby. If they make that like episode 2, episode 3, then that's going to be everything. If they draw it out over the course of the season, maybe not. Maybe we'll get to see other things before then. But the sins of the fathers, the actions of his past, are carrying through to the present. The scale of what Joel did at the end of season 1 can't be forgotten. The show hasn't forgotten it. They want us to remember it. And I think the meditation on that, the crime of that, the ethics of that, is something the show can't leave behind and is going to resonate into this season. The fact that we got Abby at the very first moment, the fact that we closed with Abby, there's going to be a lot of relationship moments between Joel and Ellie and everything else, but I think what Joel did at the end of the last season and how that is continuing to resonate in the world when it comes to Ellie, when it comes to the people that it directly, murderously affected, is going to be the central theme of this season.
Yeah, we agree. I think, you know, hope sounds strong based on what this plot element is, but I just think it would be good for the show. I do hope we have a plot where Joel dies because that demise, there can be a lesson in it, right? Of him being like making this choice that was something I think strongly that he shouldn't have done, but also staying relatively hard headed about it afterwards. And Joel just being that sort of hard headed, obstinate sort of guy, and that catching up with him eventually makes a lot of sense. It reset the show. Characters could then react from that in the same way that they're reacting now from what had happened at the end of season 1 with Joel's decision to shoot up the hospital. I think that would be a good place for this to go. If they're not going to go there, then something similar, some other big event, maybe it's the destruction of Jackson, I'm not sure, but like some other big event. I don't want to be in a position where we're rehashing this in season 3. So I agree with you. Let's hash it out now, but let's work through that and then drive to another seminal event. That's my hope for season 2.
I am hopeful. I think this show knows what it wants to do. Video game was incredibly successful. I don't know much about the plot, but from what I know about people's reactions to it, it seemed like it certainly affected people. So I'm hopeful that whatever works so well there is going to translate well to this screen, too.
Yeah, I will tell you this. Acting is not a problem on this show.
Never has been.
They've got a fantastic cast. I think that will carry a lot, even if the writing meanders from time to time or the plot isn't tight. I think that it's really, really strong cast. I'm looking forward to the season. I'm glad to be doing it with you, Spencer. We will be back next week for our coverage of episode 2 of season 2 of The Last of Us. Thank you all for listening. If you have feedback for us, you'd like to tell us, anything about your thoughts of the season, if you have predictions for the season or you have just reactions to what we've said today, you can contact us at facebook.com/mangumtalks or mangumtalkspodcast@gmail.com. And if you enjoyed this podcast, if you like listening to us gab, give us a rating on whatever podcast app that you're listening to. That stuff matters. It's motivating for us. It excites us to keep going, keep doing this, keep recording it, putting it out into the ether every week, which is exactly what we will do next week. And we'll see you for episode 2, season 2. Have a great week.